This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This Week in Wrestling, Indies and International. I'm Pete, and I'm with Timothy. Timothy, brother, what is going on?
Oh, same old, same old. Just got back from PWG last night.
Tell us about it, man. How was it?
Game Over Man, as it was called. And I would say probably my favorite PWG show, like non-Bola show, in a very long time. Super well-balanced, as I think a lot of people wouldn't expect from PWG. It does get a little corny, and it's kind of annoying when you hear people talk about, oh, wrestling shows should be like the circus where you have all the different acts. But I mean, they did a really good job here of making sure that each match was unique. It had its own thing, its own story, and that, I mean, it wasn't burnout from a lot of repetitive stuff. I mean, they opened up hot with a kind of, I mean, you'd almost say spot festy match with Lio Rush and Phoenix, but they added some other stuff to it and had a nice dynamic, and honestly, probably the most impressed I've ever been with Lio Rush, which is kind of, you know, saying something because I think a lot of people really like him. He showed a lot to me for character work. I mean, he's a guy who doesn't necessarily come across super likable ever before. In this match, I thought he came across humble. He came across, like, really endearing to the crowd, but in a way that didn't kind of ruin his aura as a badass or an ass-kicker that he has sometimes, too. He went all out, hitting bigger spots than he normally does. Like, he was really trying to prove something to the Reseda crowd, and he's a guy who I think from what I heard of his debut match and his second match, he wasn't really impressing, and then here he came in strong with Rey Fénix, and I think really impressed. I mean, busted open his mouth. Probably the craziest spot of the entire night, he goes for a Spanish fly on the ring apron, and he spikes himself on his head on the floor outside.
Damn!
Yeah, he did not land that one well. I mean, right on the top of his head. And then turns around and pops into the ring and starts selling it after the victory. I mean, good stuff from the kid, actually showing he actually sold it. He didn't just, like, pop up after the match and start celebrating, like, oh, look at me, I'm the winner, all this and that. He actually kept selling it, which I thought was great. So, yeah, I was really impressed with that as the only real spot fest of the night. Then from there, I mean, the Young Bucks, War Machine Hansen was, I mean, similar, I guess you could say, in spot fest. But you also have War Machine showing off some of their power moves and striking and stuff like that. But from there, I mean, none of the rest of the matches had really high spots. Adam Cole and Matt Riddle was, I think, just about what you'd expect from them. I think Cole was better than you might predict in the match, in that he worked a solid heat the entire way through. Didn't let Riddle really, like, kind of eat him up like I think Riddle can do to some guys. Sold well and was turning up that viciousness that Cole can do sometimes as a heel, but not the most impressive match on the show. The most impressive match on the show for me, Jeff Cobb, Keith Lee, two big hosses, definitely for me. I know probably some live bias, but I think definitely their best of their three matches so far. Great story with Keith Lee kind of being the bigger of the big men and Jeff Cobb showing off his strength and being able to still throw him around and really just go at each other for, I mean, just a real big hoss fight with nothing but big strikes and big bombs. O'Reilly and Elgin, I hate to say, O'Reilly kind of disappointed me in this one. He destroys the shoulder to open the match. Elgin sells it beautifully, won't stop going to check on his shoulder. And then as soon as O'Reilly's back in control, seems to completely forget about the shoulder. He's working for strikes and knockout blows while Elgin's trying to sell this big shoulder injury. So much so that halfway through, Elgin just stops selling the shoulder and just goes back to wrestling. And so, yeah, I was a little disappointed in O'Reilly. I thought Elgin looked good. O'Reilly looked good, and there was, like, a nice sequence where O'Reilly slowly worked and did everything he could to kind of finally break the big man down so that he could hit him with a Saito suplex. But it was kind of like at that point in the match, he had already just completely, like, went away from this great arm work and arm selling that was going on, and I was really biting into that story, and they just completely forget about that. So I was not into that. Young Bucks, War Machine, just a really strange match. I mean, the Young Bucks, it's hard to say. They're like heels, But Nick Jackson makes the most hottest of babyface hot tags ever come back, fighting off both members of War Machine. It's just, it's so hard with them to even understand, but for just pure, unadulterated spectacle, this was quite the showing. And then Dick Togo and Sabre, I think it was a great companion piece to their first match against each other in WXW from about 6 or 7 years ago. Really shows that Sabre is now kind of the master, as Dick Togo had for a long time been nicknamed as the master of wrestling. Now you're showing that he's a step slower, while Sabre's really coming into his prime, and he's the top guy. So I liked that as the bookending of their rivalry, or not even rivalry, but with the bookending of their interactions with each other. Sabre's heel work was fantastic. And then in some ways, for a show, having that with the champion in a non-title match as the primer match after this card that, as I said, was really well balanced, this felt almost, as I said, like a Maestro Masters versus Masters match, showing off Sabre's prowess now with some heel tendency, but no real kind of chicanery or cheating, just 100% really just wrestling. Then you fall into the main event where it's, Sabre's buddy and his past rival and possible future championship contender, Chuck Taylor versus Marty Scurll, in a street fight that had all the gaga, all the bells and whistles that you could want, thumbtacks, ladders, chairs, all these contraptions, crazy bumps, powder, everything, a bunch of umbrellas, all of it really delivered in a way that felt like just this big spectacle main event. So having a card that was well-balanced, a co-main event that really delivered in the wrestling, this felt like the spectacle main event that sent everybody home happy. So all in all, as I said, great show for PWG, great showing for PWG, and a show that I recommend even for, let's say, a non-PWG fan when this comes out on DVD or you find it on High Spots Network. I think this is a show to check out just for an all-around wrestling show that's really, really well done.
Sounds like they actually show some discipline here by, like, protecting that main event, which a lot of times PWG does not do a good job of, but it sounds like they did a good job here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like I said, the closest thing you could say that was crazy spots was Leo and Phoenix. Bucks and War Machine have a totally different style of match, and then you go into Chuck Taylor and Marty, and all the gimmicks are fair game for them because no one's done it. No one's done a lot of crowd brawling. No one's even really done a lot of dives to this point in the night. So realistically, they really kind of, everyone laid out, delivered great matches, but really left a lot on the table for Chuck Taylor and Marty Scurll to then knock it out of the park as this big main event.
That's cool. That's really cool. I booked my hotel for next month in Wichita Falls. I'm going to go to the... I've been meaning to check it out. I just haven't done it, but then I saw they're having their Hall of Fame banquet in May. So I'm like, you know what? I'll do a 3-day weekend down there, and I'm going to go check out the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame over in Wichita Falls, Texas. And they're doing so on Thursday, they're doing like a Q&A comedy thing with Len Denon, the Grappler, or one half of the Dirty White Boys, along with some other guests of his. And then Friday, they're going to have a wrestling show. And then Saturday, they're having like a festival / checking out the Hall of Fame, and they're having their Hall of Fame banquet that night. So I'm going to go down there and check that out and see how it is. So I've really been dying to see the museum. So I'm really looking forward to my trip down there.
Yeah, and I think, is Meltzer getting inducted on this next Hall of Fame?
Different one. This is he's getting something. He's doing the Cauliflower Alley. That's what he's doing in Vegas.
Okay.
He's getting the Melby Award in Vegas.
Got it. Okay, because I knew that I had heard. Actually, that's a funny story, because he was at PWG last night, and I heard them talking about it, because I don't know if people are familiar, but I think people who follow PWG know about the guy who passes out in the front row of PWG shows, and you can see him right on the hard camera side, or he's across from the hard camera, so you can see him the whole night asleep. His name is Joe, for anybody, so he does have a name for all the people who like to make fun of him. But he was extra drunk before the show, and he was hanging all over someone that was in the middle of talking to Meltzer, and he was saying that Meltzer needs to go shot for shot with him before he gets inducted to the Hall of Fame, before his speech and all this.
Hilarious.
And then when I heard that, I was like, oh yeah, you could tell Meltzer was super uncomfortable, because he's a guy who doesn't really drink even.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, oh yeah, Meltzer's going into the Hall of Fame soon. I forgot about that. So
poor guy. Yeah, he's doing when the first cauliflower hour, the irony is his first Dave Meltzer's first cauliflower alley when he ever went to was he Paul Brop, the guy who is the announcer and the owner of Houston Wrestling, which is the other podcast I do, was the one who brought Dave Meltzer to Cauliflower Alley with a lot of dirty looks. This is back, probably 1983, 84 maybe. And this is when, wrestling took itself pretty damn serious. And it was a big head turner at the time.
Yeah, for sure. I think I've actually heard about that before. And then
I might have the date wrong, but I know it was Paul Bosch. I might have the year wrong, but I know Paul Bosch. It might have even been 91 or 90 that Paul Bosch brought him, for all I know. But I don't know the date, but I know Paul Bosch brought him and had him sit at his table. And it was funny because Buddy Rose was at the table, and Buddy Rose at the time hated Dave Meltzer, and it was an awkward situation and stuff. And I just think it's cool because I'm a big Paul Bosch guy.
Yeah. Paul Bosch was the one, he's talked about it because he was living in Texas at that time, and he's said that he learned a lot from Paul Bosch. And then I think from there, he's talked about that a lot of one of his close Cauliflower Alley buddies was Bockwinkel, right? I mean, him and Bockwinkel were really close. From the Pacific Northwest kind of connection. So, yeah, it's kind of cool to see how it's come full circle from being a guy who got dirty looks to being a guy getting inducted finally.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm looking forward to checking this out because it's more old school, more, it doesn't have the glitz and the glamour of it. But it's from the pictures I've seen, it's some really neat looking exhibits over at the Hall of Fame. And it's only I think it's $3 to go look at it. So, I mean, it's pretty, the wrestling show is $5. The comedy show is $5. Going to tour the Hall of Fame is $3. So, I mean, it's a pretty relative cheap, fun time for 3 days and stuff. I think the WrestleFest thing is $10 or something. You can go to the, and you can go buy. I'm not going to go to the dinner because it's $60 or something. But I might. You never know. I'll think about it. Because you get a dinner with it. It's not like you're just going to hear the speech. You get a barbecue rib dinner and stuff. So we'll see. But I'm looking forward to it just because I feel it's neat, and it's going to be some of the guys who I've been watching a lot on from Houston Wrestling on the NWA On Demand thing. So a bunch of them guys are going to be there. So I'm just kind of curious just to talk to them about Houston Wrestling. So, but the main reason I'm going is because I've really been wanting to check out the Hall of Fame. Have you ever looked at it or anything online, the pictures and stuff? Or?
Yeah, I was interested in going, and I think it was, God, it may have.
Because they transferred it from New York to Texas in the last 2 years and stuff, so.
Yeah, and it was, I think it was when they were transferring it, and I think it may have been even close to a year ago by now, but the guy who's running it now that it's in Texas was
Cowboy,
on the Terry.
Montel, yeah.
He was on the Terry Garvin Sims podcast.
Yep.
And when they were talking about it, I was like, oh, now that it's in Texas, that might be something I'd like to go check out because it's a lot closer than New York.
Yeah, exactly. Even though it's in Texas, it's still an 8-hour trip for me. It's not because Texas is just look at the map. I mean, look at a map of the United States. I mean, Texas is huge. And it's still a good 8-hour trek, which it probably takes almost Johnny P as long to drive to CWF Mid-Atlantic. Drive somewhere else in Texas. I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but it's still kind of it is. But hey, speaking of CWF Mid-Atlantic, Canoodle Cup time. We're heading in, and we open up with Roy Wilkins, Eric Royal versus Dirty Daddy, and then Snooty Fox. And you know what? I really like this. I think I might have liked this match the most of everything on the show, honestly. I thought we got a real fun shine here, and I liked Wilkins' work in the arm. I loved Royal with the hair pull to set up the heat. Really, I'm all for when the heels cheat to set up the heat. There's nothing better, and nothing makes more sense as a heel to cheat to set up the heat. And I really liked Eric Royal's trash talking throughout this. Daddy, he blew that one little spot, but he recovered really well. But I thought exactly what we did. We talked about it. We got We got a small little heat on Daddy. He gets to hot tag the Fox. He's looking great. He gets cut off and sells a little. They get back to Daddy. So we actually got to see the best of both worlds, where Fox and Daddy are both pretty good at selling, and so that allows Wilkins and Royal to get the shine and get the heat on them. And I thought it was a really good overall, pretty solid match. 2 and 3/4 stars. I enjoy what they guys did and stuff. And I really do like Daddy and Fox as a tag team. What were your thoughts here?
Yeah, right there with you. And again, the All-Stars coming into their own as a tag team is fantastic. And I really, really loved Royal bullying Daddy here. I mean, he was, like you said, talked about pulling the hair, talking trash the whole way. I mean, that just... that stuff was great, and I think I'm with you that this may have been like the best match of the tournament so far.
Cool. What do you think of the Carnies versus White Mike and Ethan Sharp?
I mean, just all fun, right? This is great stuff with a lot of just fantastic character work back and forth. The Carnies bringing out I love the Carnies are turn on a dime and are siding with White Mike to get the crowd kind of behind them so that they can then in turn use that to take advantage of them. Thought that was great, you know, hustling for them for the money with the cornhole game, and just all of that to begin with was great. And then once the Carnies get rolling, I mean, they're really becoming a force to be reckoned with here in CWF. I think that they're doing a great job making them look really, really devastatingly violent and just aggressive, and their heat. I mean, they're all over them, and the match is pretty quick, obviously, and I think it's a good way to set up the Carnies going forward in the tournament even more.
What do you think of the finish, though? They did it again. And I brought it up last time we talked, is that it kind of loses its luster every time they use that same finish.
Yeah, I know. I think that really should be a special kind of specialty finish thing that they do for really, you know, violent situations and all that. But
yeah, it should be almost be saved for like a blood feud or something in a way, or an I quit match or something, you know? It almost seems across too violent and too convoluted, because it's, you know, it's, you're kind of like have to turn your head because there's two guys in the ring at the same time, and technically that shouldn't happen. So there's a lot of things going on that finish where it kind of doesn't make sense, and I really wish maybe they could come up with something different on a regular basis. But I think this is great for special attractions, if you will. I'm with you. I loved all that shtick with the gaming stuff. Like, you know, you'd be at a carnival. I liked the heat on Mike. Then Sharp gets in and he's beaten down. I liked White Mike's hot tag. I thought it was a lot of fun. But the finish is losing its luster each and every time you see it, and it kind of exposes them a little bit. And I mean, I love the Carnies. Just I wish maybe they just would, you know, get out of the box and come with something a little different. What do you think? I'm sorry, my turn. And then we got the Ducklings were Cutshaw and Tracer X. Again, another good solid match. Big shine by the Ducklings early on. I love the interaction between Tracer X and stuff. I thought he looked real good. And I thought Cutshaw looked real dominant as a kind of, because how small the Ducklings are, and even Tracer X isn't big. Cutshaw was able to play the big bully role real well. And I thought overall another good solid tag match. What about you?
Yeah, I'm right there. Same as you on this one. I thought that the heat on Lance Lude was great. Lance Lude is a guy who I can't believe how well, especially me getting introduced to him as more of a heel character, just how good he is at the underdog selling babyface. I mean, the guy just, I mean, of course, with how tiny he is, it works. But, I mean, he really gets great sympathy from the crowd, selling the knee here. I think that it did make Killjoy look kind of dumb trying to set up for the duck state device, knowing that his partner's knee was so messed up with it being a big flying move, and then that sets up the finish. I thought that while it worked for the kind of the surprise win and it kind of protects the baby faces, it did make Killjoy look kind of dumb.
Yeah, agreed. And then we got the Sandwich Squad versus Justice and Cassidy. And this is just the squad dominated early, and they have a pretty dominating performance. Justice gets sacrificed by Cassidy, throws him in to kind of... And it was just kind of surprising that Stutzy and Seabear didn't really get up on this, because they're usually right on point on this, was Trip Cassidy sacrifices Justice to allow the Carnies to come in. I mean, they pin Justice, and this allows the Carnies to come in, and then they triple team the squad. And they didn't really cover that in the finish all that much. I really thought that would be something they hammered home, like, oh my gosh, the Carnies are now come in and they've laid out the sandwich squad, and you think because they, you know, and it's great how they are able to interconnect both matches and stuff. I thought they missed an opportunity by really hammering that home. Which they're usually 100% on. They usually knock it out in the park. So yeah, I was almost shocked. I'm finding something to nitpick about commentary for a change. But I liked the setup for what they were doing and stuff. And you didn't see, I was like, at first I didn't understand. That's another thing. I think they needed to explain it. Cause at first I was like, why is, Trip Cassidy throwing Kane Justice to the squad? Why is he feeding him to him? And then it clicked. Oh wait, yeah, he's with the Carnies. And I thought that was an opportunity that they missed. What you make of it?
Yeah,
they hit it on it a little bit, but they didn't hit. I didn't think they hit it home hard enough.
Yeah, I really think that as you said, the commentary should have, because they're not even acting like it's a blind bracket. As the Carnies come out and jump the sandwich squad post match, that's the first that we hear that. Oh, according to the brackets, this is the next match. And I think that should have been, as you said, hit home during the match, because you do have the chance of the Trip Cassidy team going up against the Carnies, and they're together in the stable. So I would have thought that the commentary could have put that over, say, oh, you know, Trip Cassidy, if him and Kane Justice win this, now he has to go on to face his stable mates. You know, is he conflicted? Just to tease it that way so that when it turns around and the Carnies jump him post-match, you go like, oh, well, they won, so now the Carnies are in this match. You know what I mean? I get exactly what you're saying. I would have liked that setup, because going into it, I had no idea who the winner of this match would supposedly be facing in the next round. You know, because that wasn't really hammered home for us watching TV at home. So yeah. I think, and the two match kind of structure of it as it goes back to back is really good. Obviously, both matches are relatively short. Sandwich Squad again win in dominant fashion, but continue to get jumped. We're not dominant, but the Sandwich Squad win really decisively and continue to get jumped and beat down. And I kind of love that, because they really were coming into this after holding the belts for nearly a year, like looked at as the dominant tag team to win this tournament and to keep the titles and everything. And now you're kind of placing some blame in there, especially based around the Carnies. And again, they use similar versions of the finish with the Boston Crab and the kind of suffocating with Trip Cassidy adding extra effect. And I mean, I could definitely see that finish and that kind of spot being used over and over again is just meant essentially to get this storyline over for the tournament, and then coming out of it, maybe they'll cut back on it. I could definitely use a little bit, I guess, use a little bit less of it. Cause if at this point, now that we've seen it three times, just in CWF, it has kind of lost a little bit of its impact.
Yeah, no, I agree, totally agree. And the one thing I will say on Twitter, the Carnies were representing Wawa, which was Johnny P and I's food of choice in Orlando. So good for you, men. Good for you. With the main event for the Carnies and the squad, I really liked how they come out of the post match, big angle, hot, and. They should have been playing this over like this was like murder or how despicable they were. And they did a little bit, but I just didn't think, I thought it was needed to be a little bit more over the top. But I love the Carnies now after Mecca's leg. And one of my favorite spots is when there's the hot tag, but the ref calls it off because he didn't see it. I'm always a mark for that spot. And back in the old days, it always generated heat and got a lot of heat here too. And it's a spot that always pops me. And I thought they had a good, solid tag, you know. Again, they didn't have enough time to have an all-time classic, but they had enough to, I mean, I thought it was a really good, I thought it was really good booking in that sense, you know. I just didn't think it was, I don't think it materialized as well on the TV than it did on paper, if you will, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just the repetitive nature. I mean, I can't blame, because that's how you get stuff over, is repeating it over and over again. But there is a point of overkill.
True. And that leads to Royal and Wilkins versus the Ugly Ducklings. And again, a good solid tag. Wilkins working the leg. I love, and I think it was a really cool homage to the Canoodle Cup. and the Canuto brother, to the John Canuto in particular, is that that the heels, Royal and Wilkins, won with the Slaughter Cannon, which Don Canuto and Sergeant Slaughter, that was their finishing move when they were feuding with Steamboat and Youngblood in 83 and 82, and when they were a tag team, that was their finisher. So I thought that was a nice little homage to Don Canuto, and something that was really neat. And then the commentary put it over, and it made the heels even more special here. You know, what'd you make of the match and all that?
Yeah, I love that, and I also love that the playoff of it too is that it's the Space Jam with the assisted backdrop that Royal does normally, the Space Jam. So it's like it's a kind of still a version of the move that makes sense, but also does play homage. So I like that a lot. And yeah, the match itself, again, Lance Lude with the leg selling set up in the match prior that's in the same night. The work on the leg is fantastic. I loved the launch cannonball into the corner on Royal, that kind of played off of the fact that, yeah, like Lude's leg is messed up so bad that he can kind of barely even hop himself up into the move. And again, I guess in some ways you could look at it as like the prediction of the first match where they kept going for the Duckstay device and he got lucky that he was able to get that roll-up to keep the win, but it doesn't work for him here as he goes for it again and Lude's leg is even worse for wear than it was last time, and that's really what sets up into the finish from there. And yeah, I mean, just two great tag teams already. This All-Stars team is becoming one of my favorite teams, and now that we know the finals are them versus the Sandwich Squad, I'm just super excited because I think both teams have really come into their own. Obviously, the All-Stars a lot quicker because they haven't been tagging as long, but they're already, I mean, they both have such established characters that that it really works going into the finals of the tournament.
Yeah, they're almost like they're great separate, but even together, they're even greater than the sum of their parts. I mean, it's just they're just awesome. And that's the whole thing about this whole tournament. I liked a lot of these tag teams in it. I liked Eric William, Royal and Wilkins. I love the Ducklings. I love the Sandwich Squad. I love the Carnies. I really liked Daddy and Snooty Fox here. I liked Lee Valiant, and I liked Eric Andrews. I really I thought there was a lot of things good going for these tag teams in this tournament. Even Cassidy and Justice I liked a lot. I mean, there's a lot of I like the Hollywood, the Dirty Blondes. I mean, I really enjoyed this field. I thought they did an excellent job of booking teams and getting them over and making them interesting to watch. What are your thoughts on the teams in general in the tournament?
Yeah, they made every team mean something. Even the Dream Team, where they threw together two. I mean, I hate to say throw together, yeah, but they put together two wrestlers that you've seen in the tournament, but adding in Stokely Hathaway and the kind of the revived style of Cutshaw and Tracer X together made them important and make them mean something. And then you have great established teams that may or may not be established in CWF, but are established in general. So they come in and are really, you know, representing for tag team wrestling. And it's, I love that the Carnies are in here because I think that this tournament really, really plays up to one of their t-shirt that I actually bought just because I love the slogan so much, which said death to false tag teams. I love a tag team tournament where all the tag teams are real, honest to goodness tag teams who work as a cohesive unit, and there's not a lot of the kind of just two guys who are stuck together that might actually be feuding, which I love that they didn't do anything like that, because a lot of times you end up with stuff like that with will they or won't they get along in their tag team match. No, these are all actual tag teams, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I can't wait to see next week's episode, seeing how good all the prep, all the highlights we've seen, and all the talk on Trevor and Chip Day, as I'm really excited to see this. I mean, Johnny P and Dylan put this match over huge.
Bruce Mitchell
put it over huge. The Don himself, Papa, put it over huge. So I'm really excited. I even think Dylan's girlfriend Lana put it over huge. So I'm looking forward to this and stuff, you know.
Yeah, no, me too. I'm very excited for next week's episode.
Ditto, totally. Why don't we take a look at Ring of Honor?
And, the show that I'm less excited about.
Yeah, I know, man. It's just like, we open up with Coleman and Saban, They're doing some tournament again, right? Is this what they're doing?
Is it? I didn't even pick that up. Is that the case?
I mean, maybe they're not. Maybe they're not here. Maybe it's just the last thing. I mean, I'm also all confusing Ring of Honor as me. The one thing though I do like is of all the performers, I think Caprice Coleman might be my favorite thing in Ring of Honor right now. That's how, and that's not a knock against Caprice Coleman. It's just a shame because, I mean, he's good, but he shouldn't be the best thing going in the promotion. And right now, he's the guy I'm digging the most. He seems the freshest. I really like his heel act. I just can't, you know, it's just unbelievable that he's the guy who I'm the most excited about on Ring of Honor's television. Who would have thought that 3 years ago? But here it was just a good, solid match. Nothing great. But it just shows the TV how dated it is by having Leo Rush in a prominent position, knowing he's like out of the company, you know, and he's all over these TVs.
Yeah, I know. And I was thinking that last night. I was like, I can't believe Leo Rush is all over ROH TV as I'm seeing him in PWG, and I know that he's really kind of done with ROH. I'm just like, oh, geez. Yeah. This guy is still completely ingrained in all their storylines.
Yep. Yeah, he's like almost like the most, almost, I mean, like, you know he's leaving because later on he does the job, but he honestly felt like he was like the most pushed person on the show in a way, or he got the most, or he's presented having, he got the most airtime, or was presented in a good light even though he was losing, you know?
Well, yeah, he's the crux of this whole feud between the Rebellion and the Search and Destroy, or Seek and Destroy, or whatever they're called, is all about, they were both trying to get, you know, recruit Leo Rush, so it's like, yeah, he's the big important superstar. And the sad thing about Caprice Coleman, as you said, is he's a guy who really stands out now, but it sucks because in ROH it doesn't feel like the reason why he's the best thing on the show is like a cream rises to the top thing, because it doesn't feel like they're pushing him. It's
yeah,
more
no
of
one
a
cares. They're right. They haven't pushed him, and so ergo, no one cares about him. And they've seen him as booked as a loser for so long. It's just like, yeah, I'm sorry. Go on.
No, I was just saying, it's not that the cream rose to the top. It's that like he's just what's left. I mean, and that really sucks. He's like the leftovers because everyone else is abandoning ship. And meanwhile, again, as you said, that doesn't mean Caprice Coleman is bad, because he's actually good. Good talker, charismatic, great, you know, great in-ring action, all that. But he just, like, it sucks because no matter how good he is and no matter how much he's the shining star on the show, his booking isn't treated like he's important. And there's no way to think of him as important because, as I said, he's looked at as the afterthought that just happens to still be there.
Yeah, and he's all the jobs for that Rebellion and tag matches.
Yeah, that as well.
What do you think of the Silas Young promo? And then follow it up with the Cheeseburger Will Ferrara Roppongi Vice match.
I was going to say, I mean, I think actually our review shows this well enough already that we didn't even really talk about the match. But the fact that, like, when this match started, the commentary was talking about that they're going to show highlights from the Trios title match from last week matches start. It just shows that even the commentators didn't give a fuck about this match. So if you're listening to this and you're like blaming us for giving you no review, like, how are we supposed to care about this match when they obviously don't give a shit about this match? The Silas Young promo, was this the one for the pay-per-view? Uncensored or whatever it was? Or was this
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because I think they also cut in and showed the pre-match promo from the Trios title match from last week as well here too. That's what it was. So they're showing the clips. So they're not only hyping that they're going to play clips from the title change last week, but they're also showing the pre-match promo video or vignette from backstage from the title match last week. I mean, that's a bit much, I think, for hyping, like, hey, there was a title change last week. And like, I mean, with the way that the world works now, I can just go back and watch that. I don't need you to put so much into hyping something that happened on TV last week. From here, yeah, the Cheeseburger versus Will Ferrara, or Cheeseburger and Will Ferrara versus Roppongi Vice. I mean, I don't know. I liked Roppongi Vice kind of bulldozering over the jobber team, even like when they're doing the double kind of dueling knee charge. The fact that RPG Vice is able to just kind of take him over. I thought that was good. I think like it just shows how much everything is just whatever. The Burger just throws a close-fist punch at Rocky when he's in the middle of talking trash after, you know, months and months of putting over the Shotei palm strike. That's just completely dead. He's just throwing punches. And yeah, I mean, there's some good action here, but I checked out midway through this match completely.
Yeah, that's how I am. That's how I was too, man. It's just like they're almost doing it 50-50. But it's Cheeseburger and Will Ferrara. They are established as lower underneath guys. You might like them and you might want to throw them a bone. But man, it's so hard to go out because you just know Roppongi Vice is like a superior tag team. So it's almost hard to get into it. And that's how I was. It was kind of like in and out. Like I just was checking it in, checking it out because it wasn't a match that engaged me at all. Then we get Josh Woods' promo, which is flat out bad, I would say. And then you get Skyler, who comes across 100% more polished. And we know Woods is going over. He's definitely, he has a future, don't get me wrong. But, Skyler right now, on paper, Woods is a prospect, and he actually could be a blue chipper. We all know what Skyler is, which is a good hand in the ring and a good solid promo. Is he like an incredible worker? No, but he's a very good worker. But I think he's better suited off in tag teams. I really did like his and Hollis's tag team. I think him and Adam Page, whoever, they could all have. I think he's better suited for a tag team. But Woods here, I thought his promo was just terrible though. But what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I think that. As you said, Skyler, I think really his premium role is something close to what he was doing in PWX, where he was involved in the experience, but not necessarily as your world champion main event program. But I could see him in like a mock Four Horsemen where he fills like a Tully Blanchard role, where he has a guy in the unit that he tags with, but he could also have your mid-card title, and he can kind of switch back and forth. I think that's Skyler's like optimum usage. And in this tournament, honestly, I think it's something that I don't think ROH understands. I mean, the top prospect tournament could be used really well to catapult a guy like that, who's like a good upper mid card guy, as just being that instantly with a lot of credibility. And that's who should be winning these tournaments. But what they do instead is they have the guys win this tournament who they think have like main eventer caliber potential, but aren't main event level now. And what it really does is just kind of expose them as not being main eventers, and then sometimes puts a stink on them to where they can never then get above that level. Because a lot of times what they do is they win the top prospect tournament, then they get a TV title shot that they eventually, obviously, almost always lose. And then they turn around and just are in the mid-card hell forever and lose all that potential that they thought that they had. So I think that, this should be a tournament where you're more putting over a guy in the end who you know can... Like, this can be a bump up the ladder for them instead of trying to act like this is like an introduction for them. It's just kind of interesting in that regard. Skyler, I think, should win the tournament, but he won't. And yeah, Woods is not a very good talker. We'll see if he gets better.
Agreed. He needs practice. So, I mean, it's not a shot against him that he's a bad promo now. It just takes time. And you know what? This is the time to give him practice. Then we get this convoluted 8-man tag. Winner gets a title shot type of thing. So it's Silas Young and Adam Page and Lethal and Jay White versus Cabana, Rush, Hanson, and Fish. What were your thoughts here?
As I was talking about the Carnoodle Cup, this is the opposite. This is the false tag teams. This is teams of four that are put together with the express purpose of not getting along because they're going to have to fight each other after this anyways, because the way that it works, and that was, I think, what got confusing in the opening match, is that they mentioned that Saban was on his own because members of his Seek and Destroy unit, which is like, actually just they gave a name to the unaffiliated pro-ROH guys is what it really feels like.
Yes, I thought the same thing. I made the same note. It's like, okay, they just named a tag team that never had a tag team name before. Like, we're supposed to know that's their tag team name.
Yeah, but it's really like, it's the group of all the younger, upper mid-card talent and the Motor City Machine Guns. It's called Seek and Destroy. And it's like, It is. It's like in New Japan, it's like that team that's Taguchi and Tanahashi and Juice Robinson. It's like if that team had a name, is essentially what it is. And so that's what they're saying in the first match, is that, oh yeah, he doesn't have them because they're involved in this, where it's two teams of four, and then the winning team, those four guys are going to have a four-way, and the winner of the four-way gets a title shot. And I'm like, fuck yeah, ROH, in 2007, this is still how you're building up contenders, because you don't have week-to-week storyline progression. You just throw guys together where you essentially make a number one contender in one set of TV tapings with random-ass matches that feel like fucking forced, overproduced bullshit. So I didn't like this. I thought that the action was fine, but again, convoluted, lots of inter-team brawling and fighting, and it just, it feels like something that you would do, like, I hate to say it, but like that championship wrestling from Hollywood would do, or something, where it's like, we're just putting this together because we're just doing it.
Fair enough. I'm with you. It was like, it was a match I couldn't really get into, but finally they got me down the stretch where they worked their asses off down the stretch. I just think the body of the match really didn't do anything for me. But once they got going and they got down to the stretch run, I thought it was really well done. I really enjoyed the Jay White, Leo Rush exchange. I thought that was really good. There's a lot of shenanigans going on here. And again, I will go back to Leo Rush and his character work. I really thought he did a great job milking up the spot of slamming Hansen. I thought both guys did, especially Rush, where he had to get himself pumped up to be able to pick up and slam Hansen. I thought that was a great, great spot. And the finishing stretch was tremendous, is all I can say, tremendous. That's Ring of Honor. And again, it just feels like a promotion that's just, you know, it's like sinking. And they don't know how to dump the water out at this point. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know what they can do. I mean, the backstage reports, and I kind of referenced this recently in conversation with someone else. The backstage reports, when it came to, God, I'm trying to even remember, but one of the many people who just recently left ROH, probably Kyle O'Reilly makes the most sense. I think, yeah, it was Kyle O'Reilly because of the kind of the situation and the status as he left, with him being the champion, and then last minute they have him drop the title at Wrestle Kingdom because he's leaving. With knowing that kind of some, you know, one of the people who's the head booker of this company, his kind of the way he looks at it is, oh, it'll all work out in the end. Well, it hasn't been working out. We've had time and time again now where it's shown that it didn't work out in the end. So it's time to start maybe putting forth some planning and preparing for the worst possible outcomes, instead of just assuming that things will work out in the end, because it's really not working out in the end, and stuff's really coming, like chickens are coming home to roost, as they say here.
I totally agree, man. Totally agree. It almost feels like, why are we putting ourselves through this? We'll discuss it off air. when we get done. I'm so done with Ring of Honor at this point. On that note, why don't we take a break?
And promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with The Sports Lounge, The TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlaceOfNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your...
And we are back. And we're back. We're looking at NXT, and it opens up with Bobby Roode. And he's doing a promo, and he's, you know, talking about how great he is. Tommy interrupts him. And we have a big old fight, and all hell breaks loose. What you make of this, man?
I thought that the opening was a little bit long and a little bit boring until Hitami comes out and hits the thing. I like Bobby Roode. I've liked Bobby Roode for a long time, but I know that this is kind of testing the waters for essentially what is the main event style when it comes to like Raw, SmackDown. Is you got to be a guy who could come out and carry the show with the opening kind of 20-minute opening promo, yeah. Which is not, it wasn't 20 minutes here, but that's kind of what you got to do on Raw and SmackDown. So yeah. I get what they're doing, but for me, this doesn't work. I don't like wrestling shows that open up with this. I thought Roode was fine, but there's just not a lot of meat on the bones for the promo. Honestly, I mean, the promo was a lot of stuff or a very little amount of like material getting stretched out into a longer like promo time. Was kind of my main issue with it.
What do you think about the issue? I didn't know this. That came out in this week's Observer. Did you read that or hear about it?
No. What was it?
That Glorious was originally the song set up for Nakamura.
Yeah, it's really interesting actually, and I now I know what you're talking about. And there was a reference that someone made where it actually, in some ways, makes sense if you think that WWE was thinking of Nakamura as Freddie Prince of or. Why am I thinking Freddie Prince? Freddie Mercury of wrestling. And so it's kind of a Queen knockoff thing. But I can't imagine a better kind of mix-up of themes in the history of wrestling. I mean, it fits Bobby Roode's character so much more, and it would have been so weird on Nakamura.
Yeah, I know. I mean, both entrances are over. So so they got a home run on both parts. So good for them. Yeah, I kind of enjoyed this angle. I'm kind of interested, you know. It feels kind of like they're teasing, like Roode's anti. I don't know, like. But it was good to see a Tommy. Let me put it that way. And then we got this Jack Gallagher and Tyler Bate discussion. Pretty interesting, you know. Just a little tease. Just you know, get Adam, put a little heat on the fire, on the flame. You know, stoke those charcoals for next week. I thought it was pretty interesting what they did. What about you?
I liked the segment, but it had the kind of trademark NXT backstage promo awkwardness.
Yeah.
That they're not looking at the camera, that they both feel a little bit stilted, like they're trying to remember lines. But the kind of the gist of what they're trying to do itself, I think, works. They obviously can't reference it, but it would be nice to kind of reference, because for a while there, I mean, the conversation with the UK indies were that these guys were doing essentially the same gimmick.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily say that here, but it's kind of what they're trying to, like, wink and nod at, so I like that. And yeah, I'm excited for the match, because I think that these guys can definitely have a great match. I actually don't remember off the top of my head them having interactions before, really, so I'm excited to see the match itself.
Yeah, did you? To me, though, it felt like Gallagher came across as a more polished star, though. What do you think?
Yeah, for sure, but I think he's supposed to. I mean, I really think he should, because yeah. He's the 205 Live guy, and he's actually on Raw, while Bate is, I mean, he's more the NXT guy, so you kind of say that Gallagher is slumming it here, and I almost wonder if there's any chance that they switch the title. I mean, I guess they already filmed it, but it seems like they're teasing that they like Gallagher as maybe the face of the two or the UK show once it starts getting going, so we'll see.
What do you think of the Almas and McIntyre segment?
That's when the heavy machinery were doing the lifting and then they caught them kind of.
Yeah.
I like it, but I think that the Almas character that they're trying to pull, I think could definitely work if they play it up a little bit more. I think it was getting some buzz when it was just online and people were talking about how he was posting stuff on Instagram, partying after TakeOver, and, oh, should he be doing that? He lost the match. I think that actually kind of worked in maybe kind of jump-starting this whole character as actually working. And I don't know about the match, though, honestly. And we talked about it last week with Oney Lorcan and Galloway and how that was a great debut for Galloway, even though Oney Lorcan was a face. I don't know if Almas and Galloway are necessarily going to have a super great match.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. So we'll see. And then we got Almas versus Danny Burch. I thought this was a really good, solid enhancement match. I mean, everyone knows Danny Burch is Martin Stone. I like Stone. And I really felt he's really improved since he actually left NXT. And he's gotten over more. I don't know if it helps him all that much coming back and doing jobs. I mean, it won't. I don't think it'll hurt him. Don't get me wrong, but it's kind of like that Cactus Jack role. He quit doing WWE jobs because he didn't want to be viewed as a jobber, and that's what kind of I'm afraid might end up having to Burch if he does get another shot to come back into the company on a regular basis. That he won't be able to get that stench off. What do you make of the match?
Match, again, thought it was good. Thought that Almas ate him up a little bit too much. Thought that the firing up and then turning his back on Almas made Burch look stupid. And you talk about getting the stench off of him and all this. Like, it'd be one thing if he was just doing these jobs, but they're kind of beating you over the head with it, talking about his appearance in the UK tournament, that the UK tournament is leading to a UK show. They're talking about all this in the context of him getting squashed. So it really kind of puts the two hand in hand. So I don't necessarily know that the commentary should be talking so much about his involvement in the UK show, the UK tournament, and the UK scene, while he's also being used as an enhancement talent.
Yep. And then we get this Asuka kind of like a blowjob video, where they just put her over huge, and everything they said, we've been saying how dominant she is. But I thought this is honestly better than anything they could possibly have done to try to build up the rest of the women in the division. I thought this was an excellent piece, and it's like a piece that we've been missing for like a long time in NXT, more of these character development pieces. And even like the Almas piece earlier, and then the Gallagher and Tyler Bates stuff. We've been missing those type of interactions, or the connective tissue of the territory. And now it seems like they've taken a step back and kind of seen what they're missing from lately on their TV. And now it seems like they kind of went back to the old ways of doing it. But I thought that what they did with the women's here, thought was an excellent way, and made, I mean, even though we didn't see them all wrestle, made all the girls, made everybody seem like they had an opportunity to take on Asuka. What were your thoughts on the video package and stuff?
Amazing. Amazing package to help get over Asuka while also protecting her promo skills not being the best. Edited together where you have all the girls talking her up for her so she doesn't have to do the talking. And then, as you said, it makes it so that, like, as we come out of it, we go into this tag team match, but we know that the kind of the aura of Asuka looms over the entire women's division. As you said, the connective tissue, it really makes Asuka the thing that connects everyone in the women's division, so that even what can feel like pointless tag team matches, you can think of, well, how does this affect rankings when it comes to going on to possibly being a contender for the women's title vis-a-vis Asuka? Because even, you know, Liv Morgan in the promo video, Aaliyah, everybody in the promo video is openly saying, my whole reason for existence in NXT is to get the title from her, to be the one that beats her. So yeah, I think that this was a great promo package. And as you said, the best thing you could possibly do for everyone involved in the women's division, including Asuka, to not only make her look stronger, but to make everybody look like, oh, okay, so that's it. Everyone has a focus. Because it does get really ridiculous in wrestling when you don't have that kind of clearly stated goal that everyone has. I mean, they're not supposed to say, you know, if you're not in this to be the champion, then you shouldn't be in wrestling at all anymore. And in some ways, that's exactly what this video was saying.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I loved it. And then we got a tie-in and sanity video package. What would you make of this thing?
Good video package, but again, we talked about kind of our issues with this program still kind of being kind of hangover or leftovers in NXT when Ty's already on the main roster.
Yeah, exactly. And then we got Aaliyah and Liv Morgan versus the Mean Girls. And honestly, in my notes, I joke, Aaliyah and Liv have been beaten like drums by the Mean Girls. Maybe they'll get a win for a change. And oh my God, they do. And it's about time for the faces. Because technically, I mean, this has kind of been built as a feud almost, these four girls. And the Mean Girls have just beat the crap out of the babyfaces nonstop, drum like a drum roll. And finally, I mean, it wasn't a great match or anything, but the girls score a flash pin, and it was about damn time, because it felt like, okay, great, we've seen this, done that. I think they've wrestled probably at least in different combinations of singles and tags in the last 6 months. I bet you we've gotten it at least once a week, on average. And not necessarily once a week, but they've been averaging it once a week. And the heels going over every time. Finally, the girls, the baby faces squeak one out. I'm happy. What about you?
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, it was coming out of that promo video into this. I mean, everybody's repackaged. Liv comes out to a different mix of her song. She's not doing as much of the kind of standing and posing dancing stuff that she was doing before. Aaliyah's got the bunny ears or whatever, the cat ears, whatever it is. Yeah. They're trying to actually have some kind of character for her, which is nice. Peyton was about the same, but Billy had the two-piece gear instead of the one-piece, which was not necessarily super flattering for her. So the two-piece, she definitely looks better in. And yeah, they get into the match. Liv does her trademark Kiwi roll that she loves to do constantly. Billy Kay does a slow, really lame-looking rolling elbow. The iconic duo's double team spots are great because as they kind of mockingly mess with each other rather than being vicious and violent and destroying their opponents, it really plays up their character that they're more about just like their friendship and being dicks than they are about like winning matches and beating people up. And I did like the finish, as you said, because it can finally give some credibility to Liv and Aaliyah. And I think that they really kind of are trying to reset. I mean, I talked about last week's episode really feeling like a reset in general for NXT. This episode feels like a definite reset for the women's division as a whole. And even people that we've been seeing primarily are like pretty regularly on TV feel like they're now kind of repurposed with focus.
Yeah, and then we get obviously the main event. I mean, it was a bon voyage to Ty Dillinger. But I enjoyed this cage match. I liked that they used the cage as a weapon. Young's busted open. Young with a flying elbow from the top. I thought both guys worked hard and told a good story. And again, it made me care. I gave it 3.5 stars. I didn't think that's something they could tug on my heartstrings. But they actually did a good job here. And I thought they worked it really good. Young with that flying elbow from the top was nuts. Just overall good stuff. I thought it was like a good solid 3.5-star cage match. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Love the fire, love the blood, love the cage being actually used. When he's throwing him from side of the cage to side of the cage, I'm like, oh God, it's great to see him actually using the cage and making it feel important that this is a cage match, but yep. if EY's not going to bleed, then this is going to drive me crazy, and then I start to see the blood coming, and I'm like, thank God. Then there's the big elbow drop from the top. It's an interesting move from a heel, because that's usually a lot of times the valiant babyface who decides that rather than going for the win, he takes the big risk off the top, but, I mean, it's supposed to be that EY is, like, insane crazy. And everyone coming out, tying in the rest of the storylines, they lock the door on him. I thought it was weird that Sanity locks the door, but then they try to climb over the top of the cage. It's very interesting for a guy like Killian Dane to be trying to do. You think you could have the two big guys go in, lock the door, and then have the girl climb over the top because she's a little bit quicker, faster at climbing, but no. But it works for the story. But here, my only issue with the match is Ty comes in super hot. He's fired up, decent. Then the second he gets, EY gets a little bit offense of him, he's trying to climb out of the cage. Not a fan of the valiant babyface trying to run from a fight. And I'm just not a fan of the WWE modern style of cage match where you win that way, because even if Ty was kind of fighting off 2-on-1 and he gets the win as he's trying to, you know, get away from an even more unfair advantage, I don't like the visual of the babyface won by running away from a fight. You know what I mean? It's just, that doesn't necessarily work for me, but I'm with you. I think it's definitely 3.5 star, great cage match out of both guys. It's just the internal logic for me of WWE style cage matches doesn't work.
Oh yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I mean, it's nothing like an old school cage match. I've never really been a big fan of the climb either. But man, that was NXT, and I really did feel like an old school NXT show episode where they really built some of the feuds up, built the angles. We got some payoffs off some of the angles. Overall, I thought it was really, really well structured, and I'd give it an easy thumbs up. Then it breezed through really quickly. What about you?
Yeah, no question. I'd say if you listen to us in our NXT review to decide if you should watch go back, watch last week's, watch this week's, and then stay current, because it feels like they're back in kind of their form, and now we're going to start mixing in more of the UK guys, maybe mix in some of the cruiserweights, build towards the women's tournament. I mean, NXT is looking to be kind of maybe hitting its silver age, or, you know, the next kind of boom period of NXT, I think, is right around the corner.
Yeah, phase 3. So on that note, why don't we take a break? When we come back, we're going to be looking at some Revolution Pro Wrestling.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
And we are back. And it opens up with Sami Callihan. And who's he teaming with?
Martin Stone /
Oh, yeah, Martin
Danny
Stone.
Birch.
Right. And Danny Birch versus Chris Burks and Travis Banks. I thought the offense, I thought Callihan and Stone's offense looks crisp. I thought the shine was pretty good. Stone's non-dive spot, it took way too long to set up and ended up being pretty convoluted and kind of a dud for me. I thought it was like a better idea on paper than how they executed it. I've been burned out by the around the world chair spot where the guys run around and then kick somebody in a chair. Not only do we get that, we get it a second and third time. I mean, it felt like this spot never ended on this opening match. Really got to me. Everyone is working hard. I enjoyed the pinfall. And post-match, we see Callihan turn on Stone. Makes perfect sense. I thought it was a good, solid opener. 2.5. What about you?
Liked it a little bit more than you for, like, the subtle kind of storytelling here. Find it interesting that CCK are still over really strong as faces here. After I kind of said that with the what I thought was a double turn on the Cockpit show, and some people kind of told me, oh, it was just because of they're winning it from Joel Redman and Sterling. But I think CCK are pretty strongly faces in Rev Pro now, and they kind of should probably just go with it. Sami and Stone being kind of all in control when it's just a slugfest in a fight definitely works for those guys compared to CCK. But then you turn around, and I think what makes Chris Brooks really shine as a tag team worker is his ingenuity. He comes up with a lot of really cool tag team spots and double team maneuvers and trickery based offense that he does really well as a heel tag team. But I mean, it's kind of the Young Bucks thing where they're faces that work kind of like heels. So it does make it difficult. The around the world spot, again, just another glaring kind of point that Sami Callihan isn't this, you know, amazing, balls to the walls, crazy. He's just such a nutbag, and everything feels so real and intense because you can never predict what he's going to do next because he constantly repeats the same spots to ad nauseum to the point of getting really annoying. Sami Callihan does a lot of things really well, but I think what happens is, for me, as someone who watches him pretty regularly and keeps up with him, he kind of starts taking his trademark moves to the point of, as I said, ad nauseum and annoyance because he repeats them so often. It would be nice if he could kind of cycle through his trademark spots a little bit more. Loved the finish with CCK. They isolate Sami Callihan, really just destroy him with double teams to then bring in Stone, do the same to him, and get the finish. 3-star. I think it made the tag team champions look great. And the line of the post-match turn promo, "I quit, you got fired." And now that's like, yes, this is a real time. This is a big time feud. Feels like big stakes and like definite emotion and anger behind it. I think that Danny Burch can really play up just how much, because that's a really shitty line to say to somebody, you know?
No, I totally agree. Totally agree. And then we got Jay White versus Angelico. What were your thoughts here?
I liked the opening, but I think it was just a little bit, I think Jay White just really didn't hold up his end of the bargain. As I was hoping for Angelico showing off kind of lucha style maestro mat work, and then I would have liked a counterpoint from Jay White showing maybe like strong style Japanese mat work, but he really doesn't. As the commentary is playing up the two different sides of the world from two different guys from totally different countries who trained in different countries and all this, and really like the international flavor of it. And I think that Jay White didn't hold up his deal. Like the closest thing you could say that was like Japanese style submission work was he locked in a Muda lock, which to me has always felt like something Muda probably picked up in Mexico. It didn't ever really feel like a Japanese submission hold. But yeah, I mean, White with his basic counter stuff is always good. His charging strikes in here look super stiff. Angelico really seems to never get any kind of steam behind him. And then once he finally does, White's able to cut him off pretty much instantly. And I love countering the Black Tiger Bomb into the kind of rolling, the Young Lion Tamer, as I think they should call it, for Jay White, and he gets the submission there. I thought it was interesting. Angelico really never put too much offense together here, which was kind of odd to just have him really in here as an almost glorified jobber. And I gave it 2.5 stars for that, because I think that Angelico never really looked credible. So after it was all said and done, a guy that they're really putting a lot of steam for didn't look like he really beat anybody of note at the end of the match.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I gave it 2 stars. You liked it a little bit more than me. I thought my favorite part was the announcers talking about Angelico's backstory of how he trained with Ultimo Dragon. I thought that was the coolest thing of the whole entire match. I found this dull, and just I really didn't think they connected very well. On paper, you think they would, being young guys who want something to prove, but it didn't translate that well. But I did think Angelico threw a really nasty knee strike. And then we got Zach Gibson versus Goto. And, you know, I'm like, okay, this could be something. And first off, I really like the goatee on Gibson. I think it helps him as a heel.
You know what's funny about that is I was watching this match, and my wife was like, "Oh, that's one of your boys," because she's taken to referring to my boys. And she said, "Oh, he has a goatee now." And she stopped for a second. She goes, "When he didn't have it, he didn't look like a guy that would look good with a goatee." But she said, "But it looks great on him." So that's really funny. You noticed that, and so did she.
Yeah, I thought it helped. I thought it helped his character. The crowd still drowning out Gibson, loved it. I really enjoyed Gibson hitting a single arm DDT to start the work on the arm, and I thought Gibson's work on the arm was great. I thought Goto sold the arm well. I loved Gibson's ankle pick to get back to the arm, and then all of a sudden Gibson does one of them goofy ass pratfall spots. That like at the cockpit, I wasn't sure if he did it on purpose. He did a different spot here, but it's clearly trying to get a reaction, which he does. So in that essence, it works. But I felt it was to the detriment of the match, and I thought it was like kind of, for me, it's like, oh great, why are you doing a fake trip up spot? Just totally didn't took me out of the match. I thought good Gibson's tope that he did looked fantastic. I thought the car stereo spot was terrible because they're accusing him of being a car stereo thief or whatever. Again, it was just like eye-rollingly bad, and the fact they had to play that into the finish, it was almost that's almost shit like Vince Russo would write. And he kind of like I thought Goto gave Gibson too much, where he ended up giving him like probably about 90% of the match. And so we had just had so many things that just made me roll my eyes that actually hurt the match a little, where I felt like, honestly, I feel like these guys could pull a 4-star match out of each other. This wasn't it. I thought Gibson was doing the work to get there, but then they with the wacky booking decisions just totally fell off a cliff for me. I gave it 2 and 3/4 stars though. What about you?
I liked it a lot more than you. The only thing that really dropped it for me, I would have probably put it at a 4-star, but it's the car stereo drops me a 1/4 star. I gave it.
What about Gibson controlling the match all that much? The whole match almost like 90% of the match.
I liked it because the arm work was done really well. I like the great arm work from Gibson. The slip up spot in the corner I like because it's a callback, and it was initially a reference, I guess, even to begin with when he did it in the Trent Seven match. It's just another thing that he's liking to do. I kind of like stuff like that. It's kind of like that Sabu, he blows spots on purpose thing. I loved, again, the suicide dive. I'm with you there. I liked Gibson with the cross chop choke to cut off the kind of stand and bang thing, because he's not an idiot, so he's not going to just stand there and trade strikes. So I thought that a lot of Gibson's cutoffs and the stuff that he did to keep control were done really smartly for his character, so I'm definitely into that. The Goto headbutts and the comebacks when he could, I thought, were good. And as I said, I think what drops it, the car stereo and the, like, LOL New Japan guy wins kind of thing also kind of ruins it for me. Having Ospreay kind of getting involved and, there was definitely some issues I agree with you on that, but I thought that Gibson's work was fantastic. And I thought that Goto really sold the hell out of the arm for him. So for me, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I don't have much of a problem with Gibson taking a lot of the match.
Yeah, I wouldn't bother me so much. It's just, I don't know, I just felt shallow. It felt like, here you go. It's like, here's a bone. We know you're not going to beat Goto, but here's a bone, and we'll let you take a lot of the offense and do most of the work. But hey, it's not going to matter because we're going to book a car stereo involved in the match, so no one takes you seriously. I just thought it was just, I thought the booking was terrible, and some of the decisions made during the match I thought were just terrible also.
But. No, I think the car stereo is really Gibson's thing, because he brings it in different companies. He's been doing the car stereo spot. So it's one of those, it's definitely one of those too cute things that it's funny because people chant, "Where's my car stereo?" at him. But I think that him bringing in the actual car stereo is a little bit too kind of postmodern. In a wrestling context as a joke, but if he just referenced it one time on a promo, but because he doesn't ever cut promos other than just the kind of repetitive saying the same thing, but if we got a real face-to-face with Zach Gibson where he said that he's intentionally bringing a car stereo and using it to throw it back in the faces of the people who are mocking him, and it's not just like we're supposed to suspend disbelief that it just happens to be a car stereo under the ring, you know what I mean?
Is a car stereo under the ring?
Yeah, so I would love if there was an explanation. You know, then I could buy it. But it does kind of ruin it in that way. They did some great stuff in this match, so I think I'm a little bit more forgiving of it.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Then we got Marty Scurll versus Takahashi. What were your thoughts here?
I thought that, like, Hiromu's crazy attacks forced Scroll out of his normal kind of sports entertainment-y comfort zone. I thought that was great. Scroll, like, kind of goes for some of his wackiness, but it really kind of stays in line. There's just a lot of violence the entire time. big vertical suplex on the stage, then kind of goes into like a just a slugfest as they work back up to their knees. Great back and forth counters from both guys and luck spot. I like that they kind of worked in. The guys are kind of lucking into taking advantage here and there. This was really just batshit insane versus batshit insane with little thought or reason behind it. Hiromu hits his kind of trademark power of three finishers in a row to get the finish, and 3.5 stars, and probably one of the best scroll matches I've seen in a long time.
I didn't like it as much as you either. I give it 2.5. I think Scroll comes across as a major star during his pre-match, and he comes across great. I like Scroll on the arm early. I mean, Takahashi's putting his body on the line. I love Takahashi with the kick after Scroll chicken wings it. I thought it was great. Takahashi sells the finger grab spot. And Scroll seems to be kind of like running out of spots here and there. I'm not exactly sure. Just something was missing here from the match for me. But as a personality, I think Scroll has it all. But man, he needs to translate it, because it seems like the work is now catching up to him, if you will.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that.
What do you think of Ospreay versus Bodum?
Ospreay has terrible KT tape on the back on his back, just in the middle, that makes no sense and is not how it works. He's got the cupping hicking marks all over his shoulders, so he's definitely trying to, either he really is like just completely banged up, or he's trying to put it over that he's all banged up, which is nice. I mean, you do hear sometimes, I wonder about Meltzer's reports, as he said, oh, you know, I heard reported a week back or so that Ospreay's back was all banged up. And then I go, well, did you hear that report from people that saw him at the Rev Pro show with his back all taped up, selling his back a bunch, and they're saying it was banged up in a match, and you're taking it as like a shoot, or I don't know. But either way, Bodum goes straight from the back from there. He's working it over the whole time. I like, as they're on the floor, Bodum's still, as I said, working over the back completely. I really hate when the ref is kind of holding Bodum back but also not ending the match. I don't think that that's right. Unless, I guess, if you want to argue that Bodum kind of took a cheap underhanded attack to hurt the back, then you could say you're giving Ospreay a chance to recover from an illegal move. But either way, it's just the wrestling rules have never been explained clearly enough in that regard to really make me accept like why the referee would be in a weird in-between stoppage and kind of DQ area where he's not, you know, accepting one or the other. Bodum does a crazy flip dive to the floor. Ospreay hits a nice handspring enziguri out of nowhere, which I think is good. Ospreay continuously sells the back as much as he can. I loved that Ospreay, with the back injury, he sets up the cheeky Nando's kick, he hits it, and then he just rolls up Bodum out of the cheeky Nando's kick. Really kind of basic, using that move to set up a near fall that you don't necessarily see him doing regularly, because he normally goes for something flashy, but here he's hurt, so he's going right into just trying to get the pin. Cross leg brain buster from Ospreay that I don't like, based on his back injury and that Bodum is so much bigger than him. Again, it just shows Ospreay is kind of not selling in the moves. He may sell by grabbing his back here and there, but he's not thinking about selling kind of holistically in the psychology of the match. I love the Project Ciampa from Bodum, and would have liked that as the finish because of the story of working over the back, and I think it's just a stronger finishing hold in general, as he then does eventually end up with winning with the Bliss Buster, which I don't like as a finishing move as much. Ospreay kind of looking for this twisty leg hold that just looks weird and doesn't work. As I kind of like it in that you're showing Ospreay's, you know, desperation, and that supposedly Bodum's knee got injured somewhere in the match, but I don't remember seeing the knee injury. I didn't feel like I really got the knee injury, so I just kind of, that felt like a little tacked on and really didn't necessarily need to be there. I gave it 3 stars. I think both guys looked fine, but there was definitely some glaring holes in both of their abilities. Some definitely reckless kind of suplexes from Bodum. The big flip dive to the outside looked like it could have hurt almost everybody involved, even the fans in the front row, as Bodum kind of over-rotated and hit his legs and on the guardrail almost in a standing position, having done the flip to the floor. And yeah, just all in all, I mean, Bodum is kind of a lump of just dumb muscle, and he's kind of reckless out there sometimes. But the match itself, the story was good. The selling was spotty, but I didn't hate it.
Fair enough. I liked it a lot more than you. I give it 4 stars. I liked Bodum targeting Ospreay's bad back. I thought there was a nice revenge spot by Ospreay by then going after Bodum's back. I like Ospreay destroying Bodum's knee into the post. I thought that was wicked looking. I'm liking Ospreay using the leg kicks to try to take Bodum down. I thought Will's selling of the back was really well done here. And I thought this was one of Ospreay's better performances when it wasn't relying on high spots that we've seen him at. And then we see Bodum, and then he's targeting the back. So we have Ospreay after the legs versus Bodum after the back. Will back to Bodum's legs. You believe Will's back is just totally fucked the way he's selling and in the pain he looks like he's in. The Bodum breaker was sick, and I really loved this thing. I thought it was smartly worked. I thought they built a match smartly. I thought everything they did was really just smart and showed that Ospreay can have a different match. That it wasn't relying on all these amazing high spots where he could actually sell they could actually work it around limb work and selling and body parts. So I thought it was a different layer from actually both guys, to tell you the truth. What do you think of James Castle versus Shaw Samuels? Oh, no, that's me. I thought this was garbage. No DQ match. It was kind of there to give a breather to the next up two main events. I thought it was just, it was like one of the, it's weird because I guess everybody else was, there was a mega stars and these are like the bottom of the barrel guys on the show. And it was kind of that was what I felt like, you know, what'd you make of it?
Yeah, same. I think I give it dud. Don't care about the match. Don't care about the post-match angle, shaving the mohawk.
Yeah.
Don't really care about these guys. So, yeah. Yeah, this was pointless. I almost don't know if you necessarily needed a breather. I think you could have done without this match altogether.
I totally agree. Yeah, why pay him? Then we get Kushida versus Zack Sabre Jr. I just want to push out before I go to you. This is kind of like a dream match for me. Like, I felt these are two of the best guys ever. Or two of the best guys around right now at working in limb, and I was really dying to see this match, and I'm so happy they booked it. What did you make of the match?
Probably right there with you. Super excited for the match on paper. Won't say that it was disappointing, but maybe under-delivered from what I would expect. It is their first matchup, though. Good grappling to start. Nice little notes of grittiness from Sabre doing stuff like grinding his elbow into different joints. Kushida showing off he can stand toe-to-toe. I loved him kind of every counter going right back into the two-on-one arm wringer. That's, you know, reminds me of old Okada matches and stuff like that where you go back to the same hold over and over again. Interesting kind of different approach from Zack Sabre Jr. here, working holds all over the whole body of Kushida, while Kushida focuses primarily on the arm to start. Then as we kind of settle into it, Kushida goes after the ankles some here and there as well. I think my biggest issue is I might be a little burnt out with modern wrestling at the moment, to where something like this really felt almost too toned down in some ways. The crowd was definitely biting on everything. I loved as it kind of devolved into a big strike fest at the end, but there was kind of some times where it felt like they're standing there waiting. ZSJ's like waiting for what to do next, and I think he really works better when he's got a very sure game plan where he's going from like move to move with a kind of cold, calculated precision. Here it felt like he was unsure of himself. He didn't know what his next move was meant to be. That could definitely be coming from just unfamiliarity of working with Kushida specifically. As I said, I think this really felt like it could have been something out of the 70s style, just kind of modern, more modernized version of it, but really kind of toned down, not a lot of crazy high spots in action and no dives, nothing like that. But there was some, you know, like I guess there was some dives, and that was one thing I think that the trope, and I'll steal this from Quentin Moody, as he kind of mentioned it to me as well. And there's a little bit too much of the dive caught into a submission spot with the kind of 450s and different stuff like that. I think that move is getting kind of overdone everywhere in general. Love Sabre getting the counter of the rolling cradle into his own rolling cradle for the thing, for the finish. I said the thing, for the pin. 3¾ star, as I said, didn't, not bad, not disappointed in the match, but just kind of had high expectations.
Okay, yeah, I liked it a little bit more than you. I give it 4¼. And I really liked the grappling early on, and we'll see Kushida instantly going after the arm. Zach finding ways to escape. Love Zach with the cavat into a head scissor. Dig how Kushida finds ways to get back to the arm, all different avenues he goes through. Like Zach, and he's after the neck. And I thought Kushida sold the neck real well. And then we see Zach destroying Kushida's legs. The submission work was well worked here, where it was well done. Zach has now worked over Kushida's arm, and it's a mess after Zach just worked it over for a bit. Kushida's Pele kick into an ankle lock, then into the leg lock was fantastic. Top rope arm breaker by Kushida ruled. Kushida is punching the arm. I really liked Kushida's work here. I enjoyed Zach, but I thought Kushida really did bring it, bring the intensity and brought it. What you make of the Elite versus Rush, Strickland, and Smile?
My note here says lots of everything. This was an interesting match in the kind of context of the Elite's tour of the UK, as they kind of fucking murder everybody except for Leo Rush. They really kind of, you know, he gets a chance to shine here and there, but realistically, Shane and Smile, if they're not disappeared, they're getting destroyed. Smile, this is kind of a common theme for Smile, as he's a guy who really disappears in tag matches, especially tag matches like this.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the guy is just, I think maybe he's trying to protect himself or something, but, I mean, he is just not involved. Elite get the win with the double Meltzer driver. This is a 3-star fucking spectacular crazy spot fest. If you're into this kind of match, you probably give it 4 stars and wet yourself after all the action. But for me, I think it was bereft of any long-term storytelling. And for me, I think that these UK companies bringing in the Elite, thinking that it pops a house, should really stop and think about their long-term. They're probably better off pushing their guys that are going to be here every month more than they are just popping a house by having the Elite kind of destroy your top stars.
Yeah, they kind of have Wrestle Circus syndrome in a way. I enjoyed it a little bit more than you. I gave it 3.5. I thought Leo Rush stood out early on in the match, and I totally loved the they totally did the Lucha Airball comedy spot early, and it got over huge. I loved the Elite showing ass early on, and then the Elite cheat to turn the table, turn the tide, so I like that. They get some heat on Strickland, and he hot tags the Rush. Small shine, but he's only to get cut off, and then we see we get the Terminator dives by the Elite. The Elite is in control for a bit, but then Strickland runs wild, and the dive off Jackson's chest to a moonsault to the floor was great, and he did the same spot in a 3-way at Wrestle Circus, and it was just as awesome there.
He did it in that tag on the RPW show that we watched.
RPW, yep. Yeah, it's just like it's a great spot, don't get me wrong. Omega cuts him off with the knee strike, faces recover, both teams throwing big moves down the stretch. It felt like the Elite took a little too much of the match, but I still enjoyed it. It was a pretty strong spot fest. What do you think overall of everything here?
I guess it's really weird the way that kind of this happens on some shows where we balance out. I mean, there's stuff that I think I liked more than you. There's stuff that you liked more than me. But I think the show overall is enough in the middle that it's watchable. But I would recommend doing what I did the first time I watched this show, and not going back and rewatching it. Just skip the Castle versus Shaw Samuels match. There's no point in watching it.
Yeah, zero. There's no point at all.
Yeah, that's the only kind of thumbs down thing on the show. Everything else I thought was decent to good.
I think
that the undercard did a great job of kind of setting up their stars. And I think the only one that was maybe an issue was, again, the main event that kind of devalued their guys. But otherwise, the whole thing was done pretty well. It was kind of interesting because this was another setting. Even though this was technically a title match, it was very similar to the PWG show that I was at last night where Sabre was in the semi-main as the champion in more of a showcase match. And it has a totally different feel. You likened him to the touring NWA champion, and now he's feeling, in some ways, these matches are feeling less like the touring champion and more like a showcase star of the territory. He's really started to kind of cement himself in certain companies as a kind of a tentpole character and less of an attraction.
Yeah, I totally buy into that. I enjoyed the show too. I thought it built well, and bottom line is the fans seemed like they were kind of dead early on, but come the Zach Gibson match, it feel like they finally came alive. And I mean, they were super hot for the main event. I think I'd recommend the show. I think there was enough good wrestling on it to pique your interest and stuff. But hey, Tim, what do you got to plug, man?
Lucha Undead has been on a bit of a hiatus. It's a mixture of my co-host getting married, having trouble booking guests, and me being slightly lazy. Should be back here next week. Other than that, I mean, I've got this show. I should have an episode of We'll Do It Live coming out shortly. And otherwise, just follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at Titans of Wrestling. Keep on supporting Space City and NWA On Demand podcast. Just keep on following Tim and I here at This Week in Wrestling and all our little guest spots and stuff. And follow us on Twitter, man. That's all I can say. And just keep on. We'll find something you like and watch it. Have a great week.
I'll be at the reception desk, sketching on flesh my perceptions of death.